Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be discussing not just what scientists do, but what does the public know about scientists, and how do they come to know about some of these famous classical scientists and scientific discoveries, because we don't teach that much in school or university. But luckily, we have a few authors out there. One is Dava Sobel. Simon Winchester is another that I can think of. And they've made quite a nice contribution to science by delving into interesting stories and bringing out the personalities who are involved in the science. And in her latest book, Dava Sobel, has decided to write about the ladies of the Harvard Observatory, who in the earliest part of the 20th century did some really fantastic, simple work, just sort of looking at the relative intensities of stars, but made some very, very important discoveries. So, Dava, welcome to Science Studio after all that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Well, tell us, before we get on to the ladies of Harvard and your interest in scientists and the science that they did in eras gone back, how did you start your career? When you were a little girl, what was your goal in life, if you had one?
I don't think I did. I was very interested in science as a child because I had a science family. So my mother, which was unusual at that time, I'm 69, but my mother had an advanced degree in chemistry.
So good for her. Excellent.
Yes. So if I asked a question at home, I got a real answer. And my father was a medical doctor, so there was that, and he had his office in our house, so I was often exposed to medical situations, like it or not, and I felt a comfort with science, and I had the great privilege of attending the Bronx High School of Science in New York, which was a public school, open to anyone at no cost, but you had to pass an entrance exam. And I remember the day of taking the test. This would have been about 1960, and we were all told that boys would be accepted preferentially over girls
Who told you that?
Sorry? I mean,
that was just sort of an urban legend, or somebody actually said this?
It wasn't urban legend. It was just part of the admissions procedure that boys would be accepted preferentially over girls in a ratio of about 3 or 4 to 1. And nobody thought that was odd or unusual or even unfair at the time. It was just the world as it was.
Well, it's changed.
It's changed now. I was invited back to speak at the graduation a couple of years ago and noticed that it really was about half and half now.
Tell me, you said that your mother had a higher degree in chemistry, so from my professional point of view, do you remember anything that she did?
Yes. She worked briefly when I was a child in a hospital laboratory. So she was doing analysis of patient specimens.
Okay. Now, when you left the Bronx High School, you presumably went on to college. And did you study science?
Well, I was torn because I was interested in science and I really loved to write. And if somebody had told me at that time that there was such a thing as a career in science writing, it would have straightened my path through college. As it was, I attended 3 schools. I had, I think, 5 majors. And I was just a lost soul. And I went to work for IBM only because they recruited on campus. But I was really not a personality match with the corporate world. And I was on my way to enroll in graduate school when a classmate of mine said she'd gotten a job at the local newspaper and there was an opening. And did I want to come apply for that? It was so random, but it just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I applied for the job and got it, and it was a job as a features writer on the women's pages. So that meant I had complete freedom to develop my own story ideas, and I was interested in stories about science.
Oh, right from the beginning.
And that was...
Yes.
Yeah. So that was the year of the first Earth Day. And so I was writing about Earth Day, about pollution, about conservation. Genetic counseling was just coming into being. I was very interested in that. And I still didn't know that it was called science writing. It took about another year. I moved to Ithaca, New York, home of Cornell University. And there was a bona fide science writer on the staff of the Cornell University News Bureau. And I got to meet him. I read all his work. I thought it just was the dream job. And he left a short while after I'd met him. He got hired by the National Science Foundation. And he said, you ought to come apply for my job. And the rest is history.
That's wonderful. Where in fact, did you go to university in New York also?
One of them was in New York, yes. I went to to the State University at Binghamton.
Okay. So now you've got a job. You're working in the Cornell University, and you've got freedom to write about science from any perspective that you chose. Do you remember the first story?
Well, at Cornell, I was really writing about the work of scientists on the faculty.
Ah.
But that was everything from astronomy to veterinary medicine. But Carl Sagan was at Cornell at the time, and he was a tremendous influence on me and made me want to focus on astronomy.
Okay. So your book, the current one, is called The Glass Universe, and it is about the ladies of the Harvard Observatory. And why don't you tell us about how you got the idea and how long it took you to do the research, and what were the most interesting features that you found in your research and that you've written about? Then I'll tell you what I found really interesting.
Okay. I got the idea during an interview I had with astronomer Wendy Friedman. She was working as the head of a Hubble Telescope Key Project, and in explaining her work, she mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt. And it was a new name to me. And when I went to look to learn more about Miss Leavitt, I discovered that there were quite a number of women at Harvard as her colleagues, a whole room full of women, really. And that just seemed like a wonderful story. But it's taken me a long time to get to it. Partly because I had other ideas I wanted to follow through, but also because it was always a question how to handle this story. It takes place over a long period of time, and there are many, many characters. And I wasn't sure what would be the best way to tell it, whether it would be possible to make the several characters come alive.
Well, why don't you give us a précis then of, in fact, what the ladies of the Harvard Observatory were doing? They were called computers, at least that's what I read.
Yes.
In your book. And so that's an interesting place to begin. At the beginning of the 20th century, you go home to your children and they say, "Mummy, what are you doing? What's your job?" And you should say, "I'm a computer." So tell us exactly what they were doing.
Most of them had no children to go home to, because if you were working, you were married to the job.
Oh.
So the idea of a working mother was very unusual at the beginning of this story. But a computer was a job description before it was a physical machine, and there had always been computers associated with observatories. Most of them were men. But because calculations had to be made to, for example, with determining positions of the stars, which was the job of many observatories, to assist navigation by providing proper star positions, any observations had to be mathematically corrected for atmospheric distortion, for the Earth's motion rotation and revolution. So there was always math to be done at the observatory. And at Harvard, the astronomers roped in their family members. So wives, daughters, sisters got taught how to do this work and carried it out. What really changed in the 1880s, again, because of the unusually far-sighted director, Edward Pickering, was the introduction of photography, so that long exposure photographs of the sky could be made on glass plates, and objects would materialize on the plates through the long exposures that could not be seen through the telescope by the most skilled observer, because the human eye just doesn't function that way. You're seeing things in the moment, and no matter how long you stare at something, the image doesn't build up in your eye. So then there were all these images to be analyzed, to have someone look at them and notice, for example, how the star's brightness changed over time, or when something new appeared, a new star appeared on a plate where nothing had been seen before, in an area of the sky where nothing had been seen before.
So you talked about Henrietta Leavitt. In fact, yes. There is something called Leavitt's Law, which is to do yes. with this whole concept of the brightness. But it's not just the brightness at any given moment. It's that the variable, I think is the expression, variable stars, their
right.
luminosity changes over time. Tell us what it was that was so simple that she discovered, but so far-reaching.
Well, I'm not sure I would say it was simple, because it was certainly not at all obvious. She was looking at images of a group of stars visible only from the southern hemisphere. So these were pictures that had been taken from Harvard Station in Peru. And since all of these stars were associated with each other, she reasoned that they were all basically the same distance from the Earth. And the stars that appeared the brightest, that reached the highest brightness, took the longer times to go through their cycle of changes. And she followed about 25 of those stars and charted the relative brightness, and was able to show that this was not just a coincidence. There was something intrinsic to the stars that made their brightness paired with the length of their cycle. And with that observation, a calibration could be done to measure the distance to that group of stars. And from there, to measure the size of the galaxy.
And effectively measuring the distance of those stars from the observation. We see this particular star, it's got that same periodicity, but it's much fainter, and therefore it's much further away.
Exactly.
And therefore get some idea of interstellar distances. Was she the person that brought that connection, or did that come subsequently by other researchers?
She made the connection, but she didn't do the calibration to establish the distance.
Okay, so she published something
calibration,
saying that you could do this, and then others came along afterwards and did the math, so to speak.
Yes, it immediately caught the attention and led to the distance determination to that group of stars. And then Harlow Shapley at the Mount Wilson Observatory used it to measure distances to the groups of stars called globular clusters, which he realized were encircling the Milky Way. And by figuring out their distances, he arrived at the size of the galaxy. and was able to show that the sun and planets, where the Earth resides, do not occupy the center of the galaxy. And he loved saying that man is not such a big chicken.
That's right. And what sort of recognition did Henrietta receive at the time, or has her recognition come subsequent generations?
Well, she was recognized at the time. She saw how it was being used, but she died in 1921. So she didn't get to see Hubble's use of it, which I think would have thrilled her, because, again, it was the type of star she studied that enabled Hubble to show that the spiral forms that many people thought were just part of the Milky Way galaxy were actually separate galaxies in their own right at enormous distances.
And so the chicken was getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Smaller and smaller all the time.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're here with Deva Sobel, an author of a recent book called The Glass Universe, discussing the adventures and also the discoveries of the ladies of Harvard Observatory. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Deva Sobel. And before we took a break, Deva, you were pointing out that that particular researcher, Henrietta Leavitt, died relatively young. Tell us about some of the other ladies that were involved. And they weren't all well-trained, in fact. Some of them, I think, didn't have much of an education at all.
That's right. But I did want to add about Henrietta Leavitt, because after she died, a member of the Swedish Academy of Sciences wrote to Harvard that Henrietta Leavitt was being considered for a Nobel Prize. But you can't win the prize unless you're alive. So the Academy had to be informed that she had died.
Well, that's a new piece of information. That's nice. Irrelevant,
yeah,
because she died, but never mind. Yes.
Right.
So go back to some of the other young ladies that were there doing this work and their background.
Yes, well, one of them was Wilhelmina Fleming, who came from Scotland as a young married woman, but her husband disappeared, and she was pregnant and applied at the observatory for a job as a maid. And Pickering recognized her intelligence and put her to work in the observatory and then let her go home. She wanted to go back to Scotland to have her baby. And then she left the baby with her mother and grandmother and came back to work at the observatory. And she did the first published classification there of the stars. She looked at 10,000 stellar spectra and came up with a way to assign the stars to different categories based on the pattern of their spectral line.
Just tell the audience in simple words for yourself and me, what do you mean by measured their spectra?
Some of the photographs were made through a prism, so the stars would appear on the plates not as little points of light, but as shaded strips. If you looked at them through a telescope, you might see them in color. But on the photographic plate, they were black and white. So shaded areas of gray, black, white, interspersed with a lot of little dark gaps. And from the patterns in those gaps, she created a system of stellar types. So she could sort the stars into groups, and she just named the groups with letters of the alphabet and said, there are this many types. And things that were confusing, she put in another category.
And these black stripes, as you put them, or these lines, these we now know are indicative of the elements that are between the star and our observation. So that gives you some idea of the atmosphere of the stars. Was she aware of that at the time?
Yes. Yes, people were aware that the lines indicated chemicals, a chemical composition of the stars. But most of the lines that were visible were the lines of hydrogen itself. And so she was looking at the prominence of those lines. That was really the basis of her system. They still had no sense of the full chemical composition or any idea of what made the stars shine. That was all to come.
And when did we discover, and I think it's pretty well known, but not completely, what makes the stars that we were talking about with Henrietta's observations, makes them variable? I mean, I know there's intrinsic and there's extrinsic, because I did my homework. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, there are several kinds of variable stars. The one most clearly understood at the beginning was a star that was actually two stars, so that you'd have two objects orbiting each other in the line of sight. And when the dimmer one passed in front of the brighter one, it would eclipse some of the bright one's light. And so that star would appear to grow brighter or dimmer on a very regular schedule. You could really predict it quite far into the future. And some stars like that are variable even to the naked eye.
They're the so-called binary stars.
Yes, eclipsing binary stars. And in the 1880s, very few variable stars were known, just a few hundred. Thousands were discovered in the course of this work by looking at the photographic plates and watching changes over time. Another cause of variability was a nova, which meant new star. And suddenly, a bright object would appear on a plate in an area of the sky that had contained nothing like that before. So what was that? And it was hard to say at the beginning. Now we know that what they were calling a nova was really a periodic explosion, again, in a pair of stars, one star pulling material off another and having a periodic cataclysmic explosion.
I mean, I could just add to that, if I might, please, that if you think about our own sun, I mean, we're all familiar with the 11-year cycle of sunspots, and that is also an area of variability. It's very minor compared to, say, some of these other more bright intrinsic and extrinsic variables, but probably most stars are variables, except that the intensity variation is too little to be truly observed accurately. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, and they vary in different ways. The stars that Miss Leavitt used to make her monumental discoveries were giant pulsating stars. Their light was not being eclipsed by a companion. It was a single star having a great flare up and then a shrink down.
We have about 5 minutes left, Deva. Did they discover up in Harvard, these ladies, many comets? You'd think if they were observing the skies as assiduously as they were, every now and again they'd have an interesting discovery of a comet.
There were active comet hunters all over Europe and the United States. The photographs often helped establish the comet's orbits, but most of the comet discoveries didn't come through the photographs. And I think one of the reasons is it often took a long time between the taking of the photograph and the analyzing of it. At the beginning, when it was all very cozy at Harvard, plates could be taken at night and examined the next day. But when the plate is coming from Peru, a lot of time elapses. So even some nova discoveries were made months after the photographs were taken. and then you could telegraph back to the observer, look there again, but it was usually too late.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah.
I remember we've done several programs with Alan Hale, who was stuck up here in the mountains. Right. And he purely accidentally came out one evening, and he's up there in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, where the Sunspot Observatory is, and the beautiful skies up there. And what a chance observation. But he was a trained astronomer, so he knew immediately what he was looking at, whereas the rest of us wouldn't have been able to do that.
Right. I would not have noticed anything amiss.
Right. Because the sky is so immense. I remember the first time, I come from England, when I first came here and went up into southern New Mexico just to look at the stars, and I couldn't recognize any. I mean, I knew the Big Dipper. That was about all I could recognize in England. Out here, it just pales into this background. Just too many stars.
That's right. There are so many that you don't see the patterns of the familiar constellations.
Exactly. Look, let's just finish off this, Deva, by talking about science writing. Is this a career that you think there's a lot of scope for, or is it just really a very limited to a limited number of people?
Well, it's been a great career for me. Publishing is changing so rapidly. I don't know what will happen, but I certainly hope more people will tell true stories about science, because I fear there's a terrible anti-science bias abroad in this country, and it's a dangerous thing.
Oh, well, I absolutely agree with that, and that's one of the driving forces for doing this weekly program. But we keep returning to the reason for that. And why do you think people, in your experience, have this somewhat negative and disbelieving aspect to what we call true science?
I think they haven't been exposed to science or to scientists. And we're constantly reminded of that by the way scientists are often portrayed on television and movies as people not quite human. Brilliant, perhaps, but socially awkward, limited in some way. And it's a gross distortion. It really is. People often think of scientists as being concerned only with facts, when if you learn anything about the scientific enterprise, it's really about questioning, understanding. It's a passionate hunting of understanding and knowledge.
And there's a lot of intuition also, isn't there? That you feel that if you go look in this particular part of your discipline, something interesting is going to come out, because you're not quite satisfied with the status quo.
Uh-huh.
It's an adventure.
It is a great adventure. And I think if more people were aware of that, they might feel a bond with it. There's also the whole question of mathematics and how difficult it is for some people to develop facility with math. And then they're victimized. They're fooled by bogus statistics.
And, that's another program, Deva.
Okay.
I'd like to thank you very much. Let me just make a final mention that this is Deva Sobel, and she's just written a very interesting book called The Glass Universe, and it's all about the ladies of the Harvard Observatory, the discoveries they made, and the lives they led also. So, Deva, I want to thank you very much for writing that, and also for being here today on Science Studio.
Both were my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And we'd like to thank Felipe Talavera for putting this program together. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio.